Alrighty. Well, hello and welcome to the webinar. As people just heard, I was running a few minutes late because I've been coming off vacation, so I apologize for that. My name is Vicky Salazar, and I'm a senior climate advisor at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, sitting in Seattle, Washington, but working for our Washington, D.C. office. Today is the RISC e-learning webinar series, Climate Change and Health. In this session, number two, Untangling Complex Exposures to Health Effects. This webinar is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Science Superfund Research Program. When you register for today's seminar, you should have received a confirmation email with instructions on how to join us for the live event. We also sent the same details in a reminder email yesterday. Those emails will both point you to the seminar homepage. You can see an example homepage on this slide. And it will also send you, the seminar homepage is active from today forward. So I encourage you to save it there as there are important pieces of information to include, including the session description, biographical information for our presenters, links to download presentation materials, as well as options to browse through the related websites. There is even an option to provide feedback after today's live delivery. Remember, this link will be available from today forward. To join us in the live broadcast, simply click the red button that labeled Join Webinar, and you will be prompted to fill out the brief check-in information and join us for live delivery. Upon completion of that form, you will then receive details to connect to the live webinar in progress. Please read the instructions on that screen carefully, as it will provide additional options should you have any difficulties in joining us in the live broadcast. This session is being hosted using Zoom. For those already familiar with Zoom meetings, you should be able to find this as a very familiar interface. You may join us for the live event either using Zoom app on your computer or mobile device or via the web browser. Audio will be available online with your device speakers or headphones. You may also listen by telephone. Please use the Join Audio option in the lower left of the Zoom interface to select your preferred method of listening. Remember to check your local volume settings to adjust your audio as needed. Regardless of how you listen, all participants in our webinar will automatically be muted. Should you have any technical difficulties joining us on Zoom, we do have options to download the presentation materials and simply listen by phone. However, we encourage you to try and join us online for the fully interactive experience through Zoom whenever possible. We will not be using the chat feature for today's webinar. Instead, if you have any questions or comments or need to report any technical issues, please press the Q&A button. You can use that window to privately submit feedback at any time. Closed captioning is available for this webinar. Please use the closed caption button in the lower toolbar to access subtitles. Also remember that our session today is being recorded. You will receive an email after our live delivery when the recording becomes available so that you can watch it back on demand as needed. Lastly, I encourage you to stay with us until the very end of the program. We will cover a number of important reminders, such as how to share your feedback on this webinar and to print a certificate of participation. With those brief reminders, let's take a quick tour of the Zoom webinar interface. First, in the lower left, you will find audio controls, which will allow you to select and adjust your preferred method for listening to today's session. In the main or central portion of your screen, you will be able to view presentation materials. In the far right of your screen, you will be able to view presenters and moderators. In the upper right-hand corner, you will have the option to enlarge the presentation or go into full screen mode. On the bottom of your screen, you should be able to see the toolbar I mentioned earlier, which has options to access the live closed captioning as well as the Q&A. Please note that when you press the Q&A button, it will open a new separate window. I encourage you to rearrange or move this window around on your screen for the optimum placement so that you can enter questions at any time while viewing the presentations. There are options in the new Q&A window to anonymously ask questions. If you do not check the button to send anonymously, your name will be visible with your message to our moderator. Now I'm going to briefly read the required disclaimer from EPA. This presentation has been provided as part of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, as part of a U.S. Environmental Protection Agency webinar. This document does not constitute EPA policy. Mentions of trade names or commercial products does not constitute endorsement or recommendation for use. Links to non-EPA websites do not imply any official EPA endorsement of our responsibility for the opinions, ideas, data, or product presented at those locations, or guarantee the validity of information. Links to non-EPA servers are provided solely as a pointer to information that might be useful to EPA staff and the public. And finally, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the Q&A pod to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we will try to reach you to troubleshoot your problem. With that, we are ready to get started. First, we will hear from Dr. Gwen Coleman, the Director of the Office of Scientific Coordination, Planning, and Evaluation in the Office of the Director at the NIEHS. Dr. Coleman provides leadership on the planning, implementation of complex high-priority research programs in many areas of environmental health sciences, including public health, population science, and community engagement. Dr. Coleman, I will now turn it over to you.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much, Vicki, for that nice introduction. I'm going to share my slides. Make sure you can see them. Okay. Can you hear me and can you see?
We can hear you and we can see. Great.
Great. Great. Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's really a pleasure to be here with great partner presenters for this really exciting webinar. I am going to just jump right into the information. So I don't really probably have to go into too much detail to convince those of you who are watching the webinar today that we are in a really important place in the history of the knowledge about climate change and its health impacts and thinking about the future. So in a report last year, the UN Secretary General IPCC committee called for a code red for humanity. And these pictures are meant to depict a visual representation of some of the most extreme weather and wildfire situations that we're seeing around the world. The map on the upper corner is showing billion-dollar weather, extreme weather events in the United States, everything from hurricanes, heat domes, wildfires, droughts, excess precipitation, and all kinds of storms, each of them really impacting many communities across the U.S. And there's a parallel slide in people's slide decks that show how this is happening all around the world. We're seeing more of this every year, and these weather events are more extreme and last for longer and have even bigger impacts. Next slide, please. Oh, that's for me. Sorry. So in the U.S., the Biden administration has really taken working on the climate crisis to heart and has asked all agencies through a variety of executive orders to tackle the climate crisis at home and abroad. And NIH has risen to the occasion by pulling together a number of highly placed institute directors at NIH to come together to form a collaborative coalition to develop a new research strategy for this area. And as you see, the president's budget for this year had a mark of $100 million to NIEHS to help to coordinate and conduct this work. And we want to do that with our NIH partners. And right now, since we're in the appropriation period, we are seeing markups from the House and Senate at lesser amounts, but we are anxiously waiting to see a final budget for this year to know what funds could be appropriated for this work. So let me start by showing you this infographic, which we developed in the process of us framing and highlighting all the different parts of the program that we are launching. So if you look at the first orange bar, we talk about what are the changes in climate that we're seeing. And I alluded to this before with the photos and the map. We're seeing increase in global temperatures, extreme weather events, and the disasters that come from that, precipitation extremes, so droughts in some areas and over flooding in others, sea level rise in places around the world. And that also, we're also seeing impacts on land use and growing seasons in the agricultural sector. So those are some direct effects of climate, but we're also seeing indirect effects of climate. So as the temperature rises, we see pockets of extreme heat, and we're seeing those are more frequent and lasting longer. We see changes in air pollution and water pollution as a result of emissions related to greenhouse gases and the downward effects of some of the climate impacts. We're seeing reduced food or changes in food and water quality. We're seeing changes in infectious diseases and vector transmission and increasing pollen season and aeroallergens. So in the past, there's been quite a lot of work to try to understand health impacts, and they are all across the board. So in the blue panel, you see a variety of different health and system organ system impacts, which really leads us at NIH to say, this isn't really the business of only the Environmental Health Institute. It's really the business of all of the institutes at the NIH, as they represent being leaders in research from the bench to the bedside around each of these different disease outcomes. We're very interested in developing and promoting interventions and other strategies to increase resiliency and to help people adapt to the changing climate. We are thinking about, and we see already in practice, early warning systems for preparedness, lots of community engagement, which I'll talk about a little bit more, different kinds of prevention and threat reduction, education and awareness, and then the adaptation, the adoption of different strategies, and trying to build a good, credible evidence base for those practices. But, you know, climate change doesn't happen in a world all by itself. There's really a lot of social, behavioral, and environmental determinants of health that are being impacted by climate, or that these factors impact populations and communities, which makes them makes it more precarious for them to be prepared and resilient in the face of these climate changes. So who are these people and where are the communities? Well, climate change affects all of us around the world in every single corner of the world, but not equally. Some, as I said, some populations are better equipped to handle these threats and some are not. So we're particularly interested in focusing our work in the future on underserved populations with health disparities, communities of color, low-income populations, both here at the U.S. and abroad, low educational and attainment groups, immigrant populations, and indigenous populations throughout these areas. We know that people who have to work outside, exposed workers who are in the fields or on construction sites or don't have the shelter of a cooling environment, might be impacted by the heat and the weather changes that we're seeing. People with disabilities have a whole host of needs that might be interrupted or put them in a position to be more vulnerable related to disaster impacts of extreme weather events. We're also interested in looking at vulnerabilities by life stage. So everything from pregnancy, fetal development, infants, all the way to the older adults. We know that people who have chronic medical conditions may also be very vulnerable to the impacts of climate. Mostly right now, we think it may be due to interruptions in their care continuum or supply chain issues related to pharmaceuticals or other treatments, but there may be other vulnerabilities that are inherent in these comorbid conditions that make them more at risk of direct impacts of climate. And since we are interested in a worldwide global approach, we're particularly interested in those communities that have the highest impacts due to poverty, malnutrition, or other high levels of disease. And these are populations that probably are not contributing to the overall levels of greenhouse gases or the climate impacts, but they are suffering the impact, the effects of those changes. So NIH came up, has put together over the last year and a half, a core strategic framework. The webinar for our NIH Climate and Health website is on this slide. And we use this diagram to really encapsulate all of the themes of what we're talking about. So our goal is to create a research opportunities and training opportunities. And if you look in the center, you see four core elements: health effects research, health equity, intervention science, and training and capacity building. And then if you look around the outer ring, we're calling these our cogs. There are nine kinds of science that we think are vitally important to be conducted in order to increase our knowledge base and provide effective evidence for us to move to action. The inner ring talks about partners that NIH seeks or that we would like our research community to partner with so that we are working on relevant problems and providing solutions, and we're working with partners that can get us to work on those solutions. So I'm going to go quickly here. We have several funding announcements that we put out over the last year, and we're in the process of making awards. We have three notices of special interest that you as researchers can apply to. And we just went through a round of administrative supplements. So we have jump-started our program and we're ready to go. So I'll leave you with this last slide. This is just some examples of a variety of research questions that we think need to be addressed. And we hope that you as extramural scientists interested in this area will send us applications and will be the next generation of researchers who work in this field and provide solutions. Thanks for the opportunity to share this information today. And I think if I have a minute or two, I'm happy to answer any questions.
You do. And
okay,
thank you.
Stop sharing.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And we have had some questions that have come in already. But let me just start. How will you be coordinating your research with other federal agencies and international groups? And I'll just add to that that my own family is from Peru, and we have been very, very directly impacted by climate change there. And so I'd love to hear, how are you coordinating to ensure that our great research is being transferred to some of those international spaces?
So NIEHS is an active member of the United States Global Climate Research Program, which is an interagency federal working group of different agencies that are involved in working on climate change. We're particularly active in the climate change and health component of that group. And we already have some collaborations with some of those agencies, and we seek to meet and work across more federal agencies as we develop future programs. So collaborations with the EPA, CDC, NSF, NOAA, NASA are really on our radar, and we are meeting pretty regularly with those folks trying to strategize together to get there. Internationally, the Fogarty International Center at NIH is really a leader in global health, and they are quite interested in these problems. We already have some programs that are funded where we have hubs, what we call our geo-health hubs, that are interested in climate change and global health. And we have a partnership with the Wellcome Trust, and we hope to do more with them coming in the next months to years.
Great. So I had another comment come in from one of my colleagues from the Brownfields program, and she was really talking about how kind of antidepressants and anti-hypersensitive medicines can kind of impair thermoregulation and really, worsen the impacts of heat on patients. And so she would just want to make sure that that was mentioned, but it also really caused me to think about kind of that interaction between mental health and, climate change, and just wondering how your research is kind of tying in not only the mental health medications, but also kind of mental health in general.
Right. So yeah, exposure, climate exposure and pharmaceutical use is sort of under that umbrella of understanding how people with chronic medical conditions, understanding the biology behind their risks and their vulnerabilities, but also understanding how they can be prepared in an emergency and in a disaster so that the acute symptoms of their diseases, don't accelerate because they're prepared and they have their medications and they've spoken to their doctors about being ready. So that's all in that sort of bucket. And we're quite interested in all of those topics. And then mental health. So we have as a partner in our executive committee, the National Institute of Mental Health. And over the years, dating back to the days of Hurricane Katrina, they were conducting research on trying to understand what the mental health impacts of these kinds of weather events. The issues of living in an area where you're exposed chronically to these high level, high intensity weather events. Obviously we know it causes enormous stress, and trying to understand what kinds of service delivery would support those communities in the best way, and how to partner with organizations like SAMHSA or using telehealth work when the populations are displaced all over, but we are concerned about the continuity of care for people who have mental illness. It's all part of our future agenda, and we look forward to working with the researchers on all of these questions.
Great. And I just want to encourage folks to keep typing in questions. We're seeing some of them coming in now, but we have a couple more minutes, and we've definitely left time in here to answer questions. So there's a question really talking about, you know, our Office of Research and Development is standing up a new kind of integrated climate and social science initiative and program, and wondering about what is the best way to integrate kind of or support NIH's climate research as we're kind of creating that, you know, new program and those new partnerships.
Sure. So just so you, to start with, I invited Brian Hubble, who's a national program leader in this area at the EPA, to join me at a seminar that we had at the International Society for Environmental Epidemiology, where we all spoke about these kinds of strategic plans and visions that the agencies have. We were in touch this week about setting up continuing conversations about how to best support each other's programs. There's a wide variety of different mechanisms and ways to do that. And I think it's important for the agencies to sit down and understand what our goals and what's driving the different components. We are interested in some of the same science, but we have different approaches. You know, some of it is for regulatory evidence for the EPA and for NIEHS and NIH. It might be, different kinds of translational activities. So we are involved in those kinds of conversations. I would say, Julie, if you have some ideas, I would love to hear how EPA is interested in doing that. I realize this webinar isn't the forum for that, but we would love to know across EPA your interest in working with NIH and trying to figure out how we can do that.
Great. So we only have about two more minutes here, but I did have kind of another question, which is, you know, as you were outlining kind of at a very high level, the type of science that you are engaging in, it really just intrigued me, particularly as you had that kind of the targeted populations, slide earlier. And EPA in the next, month or so is having a conversation with our kind of Children's Health Advisory mm-hmm. Committee. And just wondering how you see your research, you know, kind of feeding in to some of the initiatives like that, and what is the best way for all of us to really make the most use of the, you know, really targeted research that you are creating?
Sure. I mean, it's exciting to hear that you'll be talking about climate change with the CHPAC. And yes. I'm very familiar with the climate change, the children's environmental health work, as I was the program founding program director for NIEHS EPA children's environmental health work. You know, back in those days, we didn't talk very much about climate, but I think these programs and the studies are evolving to where investigators and communities are quite interested in collecting information about climate and incorporating them into the work. So our agencies funded quite a number of children's cohorts, birth cohorts that have followed up. So I would hope there would be opportunities to add data collection and framing, not only documenting the health hazards, but also working on solution-driven work with these communities and these longstanding cohorts where we have invested so much in understanding what their environmental risks are.
Great. And it sounds like we need to create a phone call to loop you back in there. So, all righty. Well, thank you so much, Gwen. Really appreciate that. And we're going to turn it over to our next speaker now. And next, we're going to hear from Dr. Elise Sunderland, the Gordon McKay Professor of Environmental Chemistry at Harvard University. She is also a researcher at the University of Rhode Island SRP Center. Sunderland's research aims to better understand how chemicals released by human activity interact with natural ecosystems and affect living systems. So, Elise, I'm going to turn it over to you. And just as a reminder, please type in your questions as we go along. We are looking at the questions as they come in to the Q&A, and we want to make sure that we get your questions answered.
Great. Thank you for the introduction. I'm just going to take a second and share this screen. And it's Elsie, by the way, not Elise. I have an alter ego.
I am sorry. Yeah.
No problem. Okay, so I'd like to talk about something I think a little bit different than we normally hear about in climate and health discussions. And I'd like to just kick it off by first acknowledging the two wonderful Superfund centers that I have the pleasure of being associated with. So first, the University of Rhode Island Center, led by Reiner Lohmann, which studies PFAS, and also the Harvard School of Public Health Center, which studies metals and metal mixtures. And what I'm going to talk about today is some of the toxicants that we're very familiar with in the Superfund research program. And we often study on more of a site-specific basis. And introducing this idea of what will be climate-driven impacts on some of these same toxicants will be expanding the spatial scales of these discussions a little more. I want to talk about specifically today the marine environment and bioaccumulative pollutants in the marine environment. And whenever I say bioaccumulative pollutants, it sounds like a bit of a mouthful. So I'll just define what I mean to make sure that we're all on the same page. So today, I want to talk about pollutants that biomagnify in food webs. And a canonical example of this would be something like methylmercury. We've had relatively more research, I would say, to date on issues related to either direct heat stress and health or air pollution and health, and less in the area of aquatic pollutants and specifically bioaccumulative pollutants, because the exposure pathway for humans is quite a bit more complex. And so if you think about a bioaccumulative pollutant like methylmercury, what you have is a situation where there are relatively low concentrations in the ambient environment, but they're biomagnifying across each successive trophic level. So I can drink 10,000 liters of water and get the same dose of methylmercury as one single tuna fish meal. And so this means that seafood themselves are for methylmercury, are the primary vector of exposure for human populations. But many other bioaccumulative toxicants follow these same patterns. And we'll talk a little bit about how climate change is impacting that exposure vector itself. Before we do that, I just want to say, so why do we care from a public health perspective? Even when we talk about a pollutant like methylmercury that we've worked on for many decades, if you look at blood concentrations in the U.S. population and elsewhere, we still see fairly high exposure levels among many individuals. And this means that the public health costs associated with that exposure can be quite substantial. So methylmercury exposure and many of these other bioaccumulative toxicants we know are associated with a suite of adverse health effects. Many of them are neurotoxicants like methylmercury. There are a number that have been associated with increased risk of cardiovascular mortality or impaired cardiovascular health. And there are a variety of other endpoints that are emerging, and they become more diverse the larger, as you look across more and more chemical families. So it's important for pollutants that have this vector of exposure to think about how these climate processes may impact those exposure levels. So what I want to talk about today is then a few different examples. And so how do we get our head around this space in the marine environment? So I'm going to be talking about seafood. I'm going to be talking about three different quick examples across chemical families. So I've already mentioned mercury. I'm going to quickly mention some examples related to polychlorinated biphenyls, which are nice as a sort of benchmark compound for persistent organic pollutants. They're neutral, hydrophobic, or aromatic compounds, and contrast those with some of the emerging toxicants that we're starting to look at, like PFAS. So specifically today, I'll be talking about just PFAS, because this is the only one that we really have many measurements in the marine environment. But what I'm hoping you're already thinking about is that these are very different toxicants with very different chemical physical properties. So as the backdrop of our ecosystem starts to change and the biogeochemistry of marine environment starts to change, then the behavior of these compounds changes. So our research, and it can be predicted by some of their simple physical chemical properties. So our research is looking across these as examples to try to understand those mechanisms a little bit more. I'll start with this, which is a visual depicting the seafood sources of U.S. population-wide methylmercury exposure. And I'm putting this up here because, again, as I already alluded to this earlier, but as we start to think about climate-driven processes and impacts on the health of U.S. seafood consumers, then we need to think about not just the local scale in our domestic environment, but global ocean health. So if you go out and ask most individuals across the U.S. population where they get their seafood, most will say, oh, I got it from the grocery store, or I got it from, you know, bought it at a restaurant. And that means it's supplied by the commercial seafood market. And those are global supply chains. So on your dinner plate, you're receiving the manifestation of the health of those ocean ecosystems globally. And any change, whether it's an anthropogenic perturbation or reflecting directly a shift in the ecosystem through climate, will be reflected in those food supplies. And this will be broadly true, again, not just for methylmercury, but for different bioaccumulative pollutants. One of the things I'd like to start with just getting you thinking about is that for the toxicants and the three examples of toxicants that I'm talking about today, where climate-driven impacts are going to matter the most in terms of the variability and the exposure vector that we see, those will be ones where we're past the peak production period. So many toxicants were in the early stages of releases or ramping up production, and there the human-driven releases we would expect to be the dominant factor impacting what you see in food webs. But for something like mercury, I love to talk about it. I'm not sure if you can see my cursor, but I'm using it anyway. I love to talk about it as a regulatory success story in North America and Europe, because we've so aggressively curbed emissions, as shown here in green, from their peak level in the 1970s. For PCBs, we also banned them in the 1970s. The PFAS example, I'm going to give you, we phased this compound out, or the major global producer phased it out in the early 2000s. And so in recent years, we've had a relatively, these benefits of curbed emissions reductions have been somewhat offset by some increases in emissions, mainly due to fossil fuel combustion and coal-fired power plants in other parts of the world, but we have this period of relatively of a plateau in recent years. And so then any variability in that exposure forced by climate-driven processes, we're likely to see manifested in the food web more in a more pronounced way. When we start to think about some of these climate-driven processes, it helps to look at places where that effect is most pronounced first. So we often look to Arctic ecosystems, and we look to Arctic ecosystems because there are major changes. So the warming is much more pronounced, and you have a massive transformation in those physical ecosystems taking place. So we see melting permafrost, clearing of sea ice. And you've also got very vulnerable human populations to the types of pollutants that we're talking about here. So you have many indigenous populations that rely on large quantities of seafood and marine mammals as part of their traditional diet, which makes them particularly vulnerable to any change in exposure to these bioaccumulative toxicants. And what I'm showing you in this graph is an input, or in this plot, is the inputs of mercury into the Arctic Ocean basin from rivers. And this is particularly pronounced in this region. And I wanted to use it to highlight more of a broader point, which is that these climate-driven processes in the Arctic have really resulted in a profound transformation, where we've gone from thinking about the Arctic through this global distillation hypothesis. So we think about some of these pops and mercury as volatile elements, and they're emitted and deposited and re-emitted at lower latitudes. But when they hit those frozen polar areas, they're deposited, and the polar regions act as a sink for global pollution. And this has been a paradigm through which we think about a variety of contaminants for many years. And what we're actually seeing now in recent decades, both through modeling work and through empirical work in these ecosystems, is that that profound transformation of the landscape is now, we're now seeing those northern regions as export regions to the global environment. So the Arctic Ocean is exporting mercury to the southern latitudes, that it's driven by this transformation of the terrestrial environment. In large part, it's due to melting of these permafrost reservoirs. So again, you've got these frozen environments that are warming, melting, containing a lot of labile rich organic material, and you're getting contaminants like mercury evaded to the atmosphere, running off through the rivers and entering the ocean. These are not just pan-Arctic impacts. These are globally significant reservoirs that are now impacting all ecosystems. We have a variety of work going on, again, both modeling and empirical work in Arctic ecosystems, as do many other researchers, trying to think about how those climate vectors will actually impact fish consumers in different regions. Okay, if we switch gears now, I promised I would talk about, I'm sure this was everyone's favorite topic for a Friday afternoon, but I promised we would talk about chemical physical properties a little bit. So if we jump from mercury and think about PCBs, and I just want you to think about basic chemistry of these elements. So PCBs are a large family of compounds. There's more than 200 different congeners, and they have varying volatility. So mercury is also volatile in molecular weight. Some of the higher molecular weight compounds, like CB153 that I'm showing you here, and the ones that we released in greatest quantities that ended up in the ocean, have a high affinity for organic material and particles. And if you compare that to something like mercury, they're actually what we would call more sorptive, or if you're a trace metals person, particle reactive. And that's really important when we think about what are these compounds going to do in the future, because what we see is those high molecular weight compounds, and that's what this graph is showing you. So the majority of the PCBs that we've released cumulatively from human production have actually already been sequestered in the deep regions of the ocean, and where most of the biota and biological activity is concentrated in the upper regions of the ocean. So that's in a way good news. But what we're seeing is then a redistribution of the chemicals that are still present in these ecosystems. Okay, so if we look at an example of that, then we see, for example, the higher molecular weight compound that I just mentioned, which was more abundantly released, is actually in those Arctic seawaters now a relatively smaller fraction of exposure than the more volatile compounds like the CB28, so the more volatile lower molecular weight compound, because volatility itself will extend the lifetime in the surface environment. Some of these simple chemical physical properties also help us understand how these compounds, these neutral persistent organic pollutants, will respond to climate-driven processes. So here's an example where we're looking at the difference in the Arctic, or the perturbation to the Arctic associated with ice-free waters. And here we see that the higher molecular weight compound actually increases in concentration in surface seawater under that ice-free ocean in the Arctic, because of its propensity to be held in that surface water through sorption to particles, versus the more volatile compound, similar to mercury, is more likely to be evaded in those ice-free waters and exported to other areas. So you start to develop a framework for thinking about these processes. So we can continue on and think about PFAS for just a second, which has a very, very different chemical physical properties. It acts more as a, it has a very low pKa, so it's dissolved in solution. It's not atmospherically transported in the same way as mercury and PCBs. So a lot of it has come from wastewater into rivers and the ocean. And I usually use this slide as an example of when we phase out pollution sources, we see rapid responses. In this case, I want you to think about what it means, the circulation of the ocean and how that's assisting with where exposures occur and how that's likely to change under these climate scenarios. So as you're ramping up production of these compounds to the peak levels immediately prior to the phase out, you see them picked up in these energetic currents along the Western Atlantic Ocean, transported offshore in the Gulf Stream and North Atlantic Current. You see them coming out of the Norwegian Sea, all headed toward these vulnerable Arctic ecosystems. And it turns out the ocean has a wonderful natural attenuation mechanism for removing it from those biologically active regions of the ocean where we're most concerned about these compounds. So this is Atlantic meridional overturning circulation driven by temperature gradients between those warm southern waters and northern waters. And that, of course, is weakening quite a bit. So we would expect to see under these climate scenarios differences in the distribution and circulation of some of these compounds like PFAS in northern regions. And I can tell from all the activity happening, I'm running out of time. I wanted to end on a note thinking about just biological uptake. And I'm going to go through this really quickly. And if anyone has questions, they can ask. But the highest level perspective on this is that there are significant climate perturbations to discharges of fresh water and carbon, particularly at northern latitudes, so in our rivers. And that will then impact those base ecosystems' productivity. And for many of these toxicants, these bioaccumulative toxicants, the base entry into the food web is driven simply by the surface area to volume ratio of cells, which is sensitive to the nutrient ratios of these ecosystems. And one of the things that we found, I'm going to skip through this, actually, I might just skip this entirely, but one of the things we found is that a lot of the variability in the lower trophic levels is actually dampened out by the bioenergetics of the second trophic level organism. So that variability will exist and be exacerbated under these scenarios, but it gets washed out. So direct climate-driven impacts on seawater warming end up being very important. I'm showing you an example here from the Gulf of Maine, where we've seen very pronounced warming. And as I mentioned in the beginning, the perturbation in concentrations of toxicants like mercury that you see simply through changes in the bioenergetics of those fish rivals that of various changes due to changing source concentrations concentrations or emissions forcing. So this can be a very significant change in the exposure vector, largely through that higher trophic level process rather than the base food web process. So I think a lot more needs to be done here. So I'm sure I'm out of time. So I'll say the bottom line or the top line message is really that these climate driven processes are likely to exacerbate exposures in through many different mechanisms. It's something we really need to get our heads around as we think about these future changes in these ecosystems. And I'd like to acknowledge everyone super quickly who contributed to all this work and stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Elsie. Really appreciate that information. And I know that as I'm listening, I'm learning as well. And really want to encourage people to put questions into the chat if you haven't already. So you talked about kind of three primary pollutants. But I also am wondering, are there other pollutants that are really likely to be impacted by climate-driven changes?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, I guess I was trying to allude to that, and I appreciate the question because I think we're using those three pollutants to try to understand that broad chemical universe where, you know, any persistent organic pollutant that shows a large propensity to biomagnify, we expect to behave, you know, so we expect the processes related to temperature and fish could be very similar to the example I showed you for mercury. So there are some generalizations that we can make across these chemical classes.
Wow. So one of the things that really struck me kind of right there at the end was that these increased temperatures were really affecting kind of absorption rates and really the kind of availability or the bioavailability of these nutrients because the fish can absorb them more effectively. And, you know, we're really talking there kind of in salt water. And I think we're all kind of watching some of that warming, but wondering if that has been tested and is the same in fresh water, and maybe even just talking some more about that, which to me was kind of a new learning moment.
Yeah. So I may have miscommunicated there. So the processes that we're seeing, so nutrients do exert a large impact on the uptake rate at the phytoplankton level. So when it's actually just a very simple physical relationship. So if you have a higher productivity system, then you get larger cells. Mm-hmm. Larger cells have a smaller surface area to volume ratio, so you'll get relatively lower uptake in an oligotrophic system. And this should apply across, I mean, there's some differences between freshwater and saltwater systems because freshwater systems tend to be closed and marine ones aren't. But the basic physical relationship is the same in that in an oligotrophic system, you get cells with a higher surface area to volume ratio, so greater uptake. So that exerts a major control on the variability we see across systems. If we see freshwater discharges under climate change scenarios changing and nutrient inputs, so the nutrient status of these systems changing, then we would expect to see changes in the base food web. But what you see in the second level of the food web is fascinating because basically that increased uptake, there are two handles and they operate in different directions. So there's uptake and then there's growth dilution. This is all sort of trophic bioenergetics. And in the zooplankton, the contaminant burdens are evened out. So that variability is dampened. So I think that this is an important climate-driven process for many reasons in ecosystems, so nutrients and freshwater discharges. But for some of these bioaccumulative toxicants, the impacts may actually be dampened by the trophic ecology itself, where in fact, and that's, I rushed through it, so it probably wasn't very clear. So in fact, you see the most pronounced impacts on the metabolism and energetics of those higher trophic level fish themselves, which I think is fascinating. So any change, and it'll depend on the species and it'll depend on the food web, but the bioenergetics of those higher level organisms really deserve another look. And they are sensitive, right, to that direct warming because their metabolism is directly a function of that. So when the seawater is warmer, they eat more and they don't have that compensatory growth, which effectively acts as a dilution mechanism. So less dilution, more mercury equals more mercury in your fish, or more of, you know, and I've only ever looked at it through mercury, but the bioenergetics are universal. So in terms of these contaminant uptakes. So I think there's a lot of work that could be done in different areas. And I didn't answer your question about freshwater, but I'm not, I was already very long-winded, so feel free to move on.
No, yeah, like my brain's spinning a little bit, so thank you. So we have a question about what is the main mechanism for PFAS transport to the Arctic, since they're not volatile?
Yeah. Well, there are, I mean, this is a weighted question because PFAS, as we know, are thousands of different chemical structures. I was giving an example for PFOS, and for PFOS, even for PFOS, actually, there are some, there is a small precursor input. So the precursor itself does have an atmospheric deposition pathway. But ocean transport is also important. For many other PFAS, the dominant, you know, we're still looking at this and thinking about the chemistry. It depends on which ones you think about. But they do have a substantial atmospheric pathway that we need to think about. There's some really fascinating processes that occur with PFAS where they're not even for something like PFOS, because these are all surfactants. And we've seen a variety of literature where they interact strongly with sea salt aerosols. So actually the sea salt aerosol transport across ocean regions ends up being a very substantial mode of transport across the ocean, which is, I think, perhaps counterintuitive until you look at it, at the numbers. That probably made your again
a little bit, but that's okay.
I'm not doing well for Friday afternoon.
Yeah, no, it's actually making my head spin is good because it causes us all, I think, to think. So it's why we're all here is to learn. So we have about 2 minutes left, but I had kind of one other question, which is around kind of the mode of the chemical release. And, you know, with you coming from the Superfund research program, you know, one of the things, you know, we oftentimes see kind of, you know, some of the kind of flooding, you know, particularly in the Southeast as a mode of exposure. And then in the West, you know, we're seeing, you know, wildfire and kind of some of those exposures. And just, you know, wondering in kind of your last couple minutes, thinking about, does that mode of exposure to some of these chemicals really make a difference in the bioaccumulation and really the populations that are most affected?
I see. So if I could start with the second part, the populations that are most affected, then the populations that I would definitively just be able to say, yes, the mode of exposure matters because different populations have different activities and behaviors. So I gave the example of indigenous people, you know, they have a specific diet, so they'll be more vulnerable to those that are, you know, some of these perturbations that are going to affect bioaccumulative pollutants. Whereas if, you know, you have a population living in an area susceptible to wildfires, you know, they're very different modes of exposure. I'm not sure I followed entirely the first part.
Just wondering if, you know, something
is that a bio availability question?
Bioavailability or, you know, you know, feeding into the, just is wildfire exposure different than flood exposure, for example?
Is wildfire exposure different from flood exposure? I think it really depends on what we're talking about, right? So if it's say, you know, it depends on the chemical, it depends on what we're thinking about. So wildfires, I would think of as primarily a vector for PM 2.5 exposure. When we're thinking about flood exposure, We're thinking about chemicals that accumulate in the built environment, some of the impacts on the urban environment, and then, you know, different types of vulnerabilities. So it's a hard one to narrow the space, which is a good, where I'll stop is a non-answer. How about that?
Yeah, that sounds like a great place to stop, and another question for research, I guess.
Okay, great.
Alrighty. So Elsie, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to move us on to your next speaker, to our next speaker, and really appreciate your kind of thoughts. So next, we're going to hear from Dr. Elena Kraft. She is the Vice President of Climate and Health at the Environmental Defense Fund. Dr. Kraft has played a central role in bringing together multiple agencies to expand monitoring capabilities and streamline how cities respond to hazardous air pollution and climate-fueled weather disasters, with a particular emphasis on identifying vulnerable communities closest to the facilities that most threaten public health and safety. And maybe that previous question could go to you as well. So, all righty, we'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. Let's see, let me get my slides here. And okay. Does that look clear?
We can see it just fine.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for having me. I am very honored to be part of an esteemed panel of women scientists today. So particularly talking about issues related to climate and health, I think it's, as Dr. Coleman mentioned, just one of the, you know, the code red for humanity. I like to think of EDF as a bit, which is where I'm based. I have been with the organization for about 15 years. I think of us as more of a non-traditional environmental NGO. We were actually started by scientists back in 1967. They were concerned actually about the pesticide DDT, if we all remember that one. They had actually gone to their local county and had asked them to stop using it to try to control mosquitoes. And then the county actually said no. And so the scientists did something that is common today, but unheard of back then, which was that they teamed up with some lawyers and went to court on behalf of the environment. And those are our founders up in the corner, Art Cooley, Charlie Wooster, and Dennis Polston. And they actually ended up winning. And then in the process, they built up so much support across the country that they decided to incorporate. And I mentioned that story because at our core, we really are grounded in science and we use science in our advocacy work. We're also guided by market-based principles, and we've worked with a huge array of companies and industries really to do big things. I think if we learn anything, it's that it takes all of us to solve these challenging and super challenging issues that we're dealing with globally. One of the, I think, our new exciting scientific endeavors is methane SAT, which is what you see in the picture there on the right. That's going to be launched early next year, and it's going to collect some of the most highly resolved methane data that has ever been collected and shared with the public. So in my view, it's that at EDF, we are scientists who are actually doing something that will make a difference. In other words, science in the service of communities. And one of the most important things that I actually learned in graduate school and as a trainee of, at that time, the Superfund Basic Research Program, was the critical need to network. And as a trainee, there were so many opportunities to interact with scientists across the country. And those really formed the base of the relationships that have facilitated much of the work that I do today. I was lucky enough to have interactions because of the graduate work that I did in North Carolina. I had interactions with the Superfund centers in North Carolina. When I moved to Texas, I got involved in working with researchers at universities here. And then it was fortuitous for me that some of the researchers from North Carolina came to Texas, including Dr. Rusin at Texas A&M, and then Dr. Marilyn Miranda, who was actually provost at Rice University, and is now provost at Notre Dame. And then also through, you know, UT School of Public Health and Baylor, they've got a P30 Center, the Gulf Coast Center for Precision Environmental Health, run by Cheryl Rocker. And then I still interact with graduate students across Superfund centers. We had an intern for a summer from University of Louisville. So I've really tried to do my best to leverage the brain trust of our collective environmental health and science experts as much as I can. And in using this network, I feel like one of the things that I've been able to do at EDF is to build out a niche within the NGO community for our role in disaster response. And to be honest, it really grew out of necessity. Our first major effort was actually after Hurricane Harvey. It's still mind-blowing to me to see some of the pictures and the incredible devastation that it called, that it caused. And I think we are probably all aware that the destruction really was a result of the flooding as opposed to damage from, say, wind. And we actually knew from our work in previous years in the Houston area that there were bound to be some emissions of air pollution, just given the startup and shutdown operations, as well as the damage caused by the flooding. We knew that the emissions were likely to be large and that they were not going to be picked up by monitors in the region because those are often shut down during these extreme weather events. And so kind of on a whim, actually, we hired a group out of California to come out with a mobile unit and to take measurements after the storm, mainly looking for volatile organic compounds. We have a robust relationship with city officials in Houston, as well as county officials. And we had asked them and tried to coordinate after the storm. We said, hey, you know, do you need some help? And they, of course, said yes. And so actually Tony Miller with Entanglement Technologies came out with, at that time, a newly developed aroma analyzer. And this is an instrument that can actually operate in two different modes. One is a scanning mode, and then another is an analytical mode that can actually speciate VOCs. So it allows you to actually scan the area for a plume and then analyze what's actually in that plume. And, you know, honestly, the first measurement that we took was 300 part per billion benzene in the Manchester neighborhood, which is an environmental justice neighborhood in Houston. And these measurements were confirmed by other equipment that was on the ground. And I think also confirmed by the fact that the residents that live there told us that they were really knocked off their feet by the smell of VOCs following the storm. And this is one of the reasons why it's so important to be able to to mobilize and to take measurements after these kinds of disaster events. And I want to just mention that we've really built our program, particularly with regard to climate and health, around disaster response and building more resilient communities. I do think there are a number of things that are integral in a successful campaign when you go out after some disaster event like Hurricane Harvey or Hurricane Florence, which I'll mention in a minute. And those things are first to be prepared. We knew that there were some facilities that were going to be damaged and that there would likely be emissions in excess of what was allowed in facility permits. We knew specific information about facilities that had, say, challenged environmental protections, and we knew that they would be vulnerable when these disaster events happened. We were also thoughtful about the work that we did. We did take risks, but risks that were calculated and that involved other partners like the city. We didn't overstep our bounds or make claims about any of the monitoring data that we and others couldn't substantiate. We were also coordinated on our messaging. Particularly, this is important when you're talking about high concentrations of VOCs or any pollutant, really, in terms of how you are sharing that information with the public. And we made sure that all of our partners and stakeholders shared the same message so that the message wasn't confusing. And then we also made decisions quickly. I think if we had taken any longer in determining whether to send out mobile units, we might have missed the most important findings that we have. And so I think, you know, once we had done this work after Hurricane Harvey, I think we were just sort of the go-to people to call after any hurricane. And so when Florence rolled around the next year, we already had a good deal of experience mobilizing to action, as well as an understanding of all the legwork that goes along with that. And part of that legwork, as I mentioned, is being prepared and knowing where the likely risks might be. This is a map of risk sites in North Carolina that one of our partners, SkyTruth, pulled together. And you can see, you can find this information in various places, but it's helpful to have it all displayed in one place. And we knew that the storm that Florence was going to be different than Harvey. We knew that the issues in North Carolina would be different from Texas. And so we started to examine these risks across the state. And I should mention that at the time, Michael Regan, who's now EPA administrator, was at that time secretary of North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality under Governor Roy Cooper. And since he had previously been the head of our EDF office in North Carolina, we actually had access to lots of information that we might not have had otherwise in terms of where we might want to take samples or measurements and so forth. And, you know, at this point, Texas A&M had launched their Superfund Center, which, if you don't know, is focused on disaster response. And so we coordinated with them. We deployed the aroma analyzer. This time, instead of focusing on air quality, we were really looking at contaminants in the water. We also partnered with Lee Ferguson from Duke Superfund Center, as well as researchers at NC State to conduct a sampling campaign. And they drove hundreds and hundreds of miles all over eastern North Carolina. And, you know, it's these partnerships really have been amazing. It's great to have a family of scientists that can network and mobilize almost immediately to collect samples and to get data. And I think the other piece of this is that the community element is an essential part of that. So getting information about where there may be issues, getting access to places to collect samples, understanding the lived experience of the people who live in these communities to notice when something is off. There's really no substitute for community participation and engagement. And as you all are probably aware, there were a number of environmental contamination issues that occurred because of the storm. Of course, there was a breach of a number of coal ash ponds, for example. We did get into a bit of a sticky situation as we were actually measuring around a coal ash pond that was managed by Duke Energy. They were actually refusing access to the site, even though it was a public access road. At the time, we were in negotiations with them to shut down some of their coal-fired power plants. And so we didn't actually end up forcing the issue, but just provides an example of how, you know, not everything is perfectly predictable during these monitoring campaigns. And so you really need to adjust in the moment. Again, this is just a map of the driving that was done and the measurements that were made. We had both Duke and NC State were collecting samples. So the aroma analyzer measures in real time. And then there were also samples that were collected and were analyzed at labs at Duke and NC State separately. And this is a natural color satellite image, which shows kind of how flooding affected water quality in the White Oak River, the New River, and the Adams Creek, which all flow into the Atlantic Ocean. And some of this, at least, was driven by pollution coming from the number of CAFOs in eastern North Carolina. So really a lot of destruction across the eastern half of North Carolina. And then one thing that I just wanted to highlight, just so everyone's aware, is that, you know, it's like there's a lot of attention, there's a lot of energy following these disaster events, but it's important to recognize that there's a lot of work that has to get done after the disaster is over or perceived to be over. So the sample testing, going back and doing resampling efforts, there's just a lot to be done. And I think in my mind, it validates why it's so important to have research programs that have consistent support for this kind of work and that are ready to do this work. I'll say that, you know, disasters happen all the time. It was actually just a few months later after Florence that there was a massive chemical fire that burned for 5 days in Houston. It was actually an 80,000 gallon storage tank that caught fire, which eventually spread to 18 tanks. And this led to the first sort of major issue was the PM plume, which you can see, you could see for miles and miles. But then after the fire had been extinguished, there was actually a larger issue, which were large concentrations of benzene that were measured from these tanks, which had been compromised by the fire. And just in terms of why is it that research groups, NGOs need to be out there in addition to some of the disaster response agencies. And I want to say that in my experience, I don't think it's a surprise that there are not enough resources within the state or federal agencies to do the robust type of monitoring and sampling that needs to be done following these disaster events. And I think that, you know, Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, our state environmental agency, for example, they'll tell you that they are not an emergency response agency. And so even when the agencies conduct monitoring campaigns, oftentimes they miss spikes or hot spots of pollution, in part because sometimes they don't have those robust relationships with neighborhoods or communities on the ground to know where those hot spots might be. And so as a result, a lot of times the communities in the areas where there is the most damage from these disasters don't have access to information, and particularly real-time information about what might be in their soil or water. And so just I wanted to share a little bit about how we as an organization are sharing information about the work that we do, particularly with these research campaigns. We publish in peer-reviewed journals, of course. We also share information in various reports and newsletters. We try to partner as much as we can with the NIEHS communications team, as well as with communities directly. One of the projects that we did following Hurricane Harvey was actually with Rice University, partnering with them on the Texas Flood Registry. Originally, this was called the Harvey Registry, but after the region kept getting flooded with various rain events, we ended up changing the name. But the point of it is that that registry was collected to be able to have a database that included information about health, housing, and exposures from Houston area residents and those who came to the city during the storms. And the idea there is that the responses will help researchers and public officials to identify health trends and develop plans to reduce risk from future storms. So eventually developing tailored interventions to help people in the aftermath of large-scale weather disasters. This registry actually became important, or even more important, after COVID, and the ability that we had to reach about 20,000 people who were part of the registry. And then, again, I would say that one of the we always want to highlight our work with the universities. Again, this is our brain trust across the country. And so having these universities and researchers involved in this kind of work, I think is critically important. And I would say that the work collectively is helping to raise awareness across agencies about the needs of communities, particularly those that are most vulnerable to the threats of disaster events. Yesterday, actually, EPA announced the selection of 132 projects across 37 states for close to $55 million to collect ambient air monitoring of pollutants in communities across the country. With environmental and health outcome disparities stemming from both pollution as well as the COVID-19 pandemic. These awards were actually made through the American Rescue Plan and the Inflation Reduction Act. And I think, you know, part of the urgency and the awareness for the need for those funds comes from the work that we do collectively in showcasing those extreme disparities that continue to exist across our country. And then I would say another benefit just in terms of collaboration with Superfund centers, with other researchers working on disaster response, is that it often leads to other collaborations that maybe aren't themselves in response to a disaster event, but maybe understanding more about that event later on. And so one of the projects that happened to spin off from our work following Hurricane Harvey, or actually following the ITC fire, was an NAS project funded by National Academy of Sciences that was looking around, that was focused on understanding more about existing and emerging risks and the role that nature-based solutions may have in mitigating them. And so that work really focused on baseline sampling of existing chemical contamination in fish, prioritizing and characterizing petrochemical facilities, computational modeling of flooding and chemical releases, development of green and nature-based solutions for high-priority facilities, and then bringing it all together in an integrated feasibility analysis, outlining planning and design criteria for how nature-based solutions might help in mitigating impacts from chemical releases. And then this is just to show kind of the robust amount of collaborations for this work and the involvement of groups like Galveston Bay Foundation, you know, having stakeholders on the ground who have lived experience is critically important to all of this work that we do. And then another bit of information that I wanted to share that really understands is really focused on understanding disparities related to climate and health is work that we're doing to develop a climate vulnerability index. And if you're familiar with EPA's EJ screen or California's Cal Enviro screen, you can think of this as a similar tool just on steroids. And what we've done in collaboration with Texas A&M is that we have collected 184 indicators across seven different subdomains. Four of those subdomains are within what we call baseline vulnerability. So those are health, social and economic, infrastructure and environment indicators. And then we've coupled that with three subdomains related to climate change risks. So extreme events, social and economic indicators, and then health indicators as related to climate change risk. And what we've done is that we have used a tool called ToxPI, which stands for Toxicological Priority Index. And it's essentially a software package that calculates a unitless number that may be used for rank ordering chemicals that you want to compare. So in our case, it's rank ordering compilation scores of these indicators. And we did this tool. We generated information at the census tract level. And essentially it shows you what elements of the different indicators that we included are driving that that climate and health risk. These are maps that show the spatial distribution of county median index scores. And it shows the different clusters show, the map on the far left shows all 184 indicators. And then the various clusters show those individual subdomains that I had mentioned. And, you know, the point of this work is really to show that this tool can help us understand what is contributing to the vulnerability of risk in across census tracts across the country. And then what is driving that risk? What are those main drivers? And I think this is important because it's really helpful to understand what are those principal components of the total risk that someone is experiencing, and how can we use that information to prioritize mitigation efforts or ways to reduce the disparities that exist. And then lastly, I just want to share some of the work that we're doing that I think is actually, making a difference. I mentioned the ITC fire. One of the major issues with that fire was that there was a large release of benzene, as I mentioned, after that fire was extinguished. And there were very high concentrations measured across the region, and obviously highest closest to the disaster site. But the city, the county, the state, they did not have essentially what was really needed in terms of communicating with the public around the risk. They didn't have a decision tree in terms of how do we know when we need to evacuate the community, or how do we know when we need to issue a shelter in place. Most of the time, the regulatory agencies have acute or chronic health threshold values, but those may be for an 8-hour exposure, a 24-hour exposure, or an annual exposure. And so when you're on the ground and you're measuring high concentrations of benzene with a 5-minute sample, and they're, at a part per million, you really need to have information, have a plan to address the risks there. And so we helped the city of Houston put together the decision tree that you see there on the right. And so when they get measurements that exceed specific thresholds, it gives them guidance on what actions should be taken there. And that was actually
Elena. Yeah. Just so you know, we have about like a minute left in total. It looks like this might be your last one.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So just wanted to share that, disaster relief and disaster response is always tricky work to do. And so just to be mindful of the work that we do and how it impacts people's lives. So thank you.
Yeah. So we are kind of out of time right now, but what I really want to encourage people to do is to type questions into the chat. We'll make sure Elena gets those questions after the fact. And there was one question that came up a couple times in the chat, which is the risk map by census tract that you showed, is that publicly available yet, or is that still in development? And if so, could you give us a timeline?
Yes, it's been submitted for publication. So we are hoping to have that out as soon as we possibly can. We think it's a great tool that is going to be widely useful for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah, great. I know I'm looking forward to seeing it. So thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
All right. So we're going to move on to our next speaker. And we are going to be hearing from Dr. Julia Rigger. And Julia is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where she leads the research evaluating environmental exposures and their impact on public health. Her current research interests surround the evaluation of chemical mixtures that occur in the environment and their associated toxicity and health risks. Dr. Reger, I will now turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you so much for that introduction. Can you all hear me and see my slides? We're good? Great. Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to come and present to y'all today. I know I'm the final speaker in this really important webinar today, but I think this is good timing because we've been focusing on some other aspects of climate change. And in this presentation, I thought I'd focus on the really important issue of wildfire events. And I would like to note that I am currently the co-lead of UNC Superfund Research Center's Data Management Analysis Corps. So you'll also hear about some of the themes surrounding data science and how we can leverage, improved data science methods to tackle this really complex issue and also help train the next generation of scientists to leverage these kinds of tools to help contribute to this important field of study. So we all know this at this point. Climate change influences on the environment. It includes a whole slew of different components. The tricky aspect of climate change research is that these components seem to interact in a complicated web, right? So we have things like flooding, drought, heat, all contributing to wildfire events. And again, these are all heavily intertwined. Some examples in which these different components can interact together are shown here through different news articles. Starting here on the left, for example, you can see an article that I pulled stating that climate change makes catastrophic flood twice as likely, where increased runoff could lead to devastating landslides and debris flows, particularly in hilly areas that have been previously burned by wildfires. So that shows some interplay there. News articles have also been released showcasing that certain communities are at disproportionately high risk for adverse effects resulting from different climate change aspects, for instance, flood damage, shown here on the bottom. And again, other news outlets showing that climate crisis makes summer droughts 20 times more likely in the future, shown here on the bottom in terms of heat. This is a nice map that I found online showing areas of the US that are predicted to be significantly impacted by the increases in heat in the future years. And then all this kind of leading to what are some scientists are now calling a global wildfire crisis, where worsening heat and dryness is predicted to lead to a 50% rise in what they're calling off the chart fires here in this news article. But this was released by United Nations. And then just a recent statistic that I pulled for this presentation to highlight this is still a really prevalent issue even this year. Just this year so far, there's been over 59,000 fires covering over 7 million acres so far just in the United States this year. So these numbers are notably well above the 10-year average. And so we know that wildfires are growing in both prevalence and intensity, and these are also significantly contributing to poor air quality, which then significantly influences public health. So shown here is an example that I pulled from online, showcasing a smog event that significantly impacted San Francisco Bay 2 years ago during the California wildfire events. And this layer of smog just completely surrounded San Francisco and surrounding areas for days and days, which significantly contributed to adverse health outcomes that are, now epi studies are being published on. And what was really unique about this event is that this smog not only impacted those in California and on the West Coast, but this specific plume was able to traverse the entire United States and localize in areas on the East Coast, including Manhattan, New York. And so this specific plume actually caused Manhattan to have some of the worst air quality days on record in the world during this wildfire season, which is just astonishing. So this is currently significantly contributing to public health issues in the US and also worldwide. So what's in wildfire smoke? It's a mixture of compounds that are produced from different tree combustions. These include things like particulate matter, acrolein, benzene, formaldehyde, PAHs, VOCs, metals, and all sorts of chemicals. Wildfire smoke can also be produced from other different fuel types, including different biomass sources, as well as anthropogenic materials. So for instance, when wildfires actually travel into urban areas, specifically through areas like the wildland-urban interface, that can also cause anthropogenic materials to burn as well. So shown here are some of the health impacts that are associated with wildfire smoke exposure. And this field of study was interesting because it first originated from studies that were conducted in firefighters. And it's really just recently that this field of study has really grown. And there's been a lot of epidemiological studies now done and toxicological studies supporting similar relationships between exposures and health outcomes resulting from wildfire smoke. Just in the general public. So some of these health outcomes are listed here. They include things like asthma, bronchitis, shortness of breath, COPD, and also increased risk of respiratory infection, including newer evidence linking wildfire smoke exposure to increased risk of SARS-CoV-2. And they're also linked to adverse cardiovascular outcomes. And I did want to highlight that a lot of research that's actually being done at UNC is significantly contributing to data supporting the relationships between wildfire exposures and increased respiratory infection. Some of these data are shown here. So we do know that there's been other studies reporting links between SARS-CoV-2 infection risk and wildfire smoke, and also increases in associated mortality. What we've been showing here at UNC is kind of the mechanistic plausibility underlying these relationships. And so these include a study that was recently conducted in Alona Jaspers and Megan Rabuli's lab showing that wood smoke particles prior to infection can alter antiviral response gene expression. Some of those are illustrated here. Other studies have also been reporting links to influenza infection risk. For instance, there was a study released showing that winter influenza seasons in Montana were 4 to 5 times worse after bad wildfire seasons. But we're also showing mechanistically, well, how can this be happening? We have data from human cell lines that were cultured from human donors exposed to different wood smoke exposure scenarios, and we found that these exposures altered human inflammatory responses after adding a model of influenza infection. So that kind of gives us more mechanistic plausibility for these relationships actually existing. But with that, I wanted to then talk about some of the research questions that my lab is trying to address in terms of wildfire research. And they include the following: which chemicals are actually shown to drive the toxicity resulting from wildfire exposure, which exposure conditions are sufficiently similar such that they can inform ongoing sufficient similarity analyses for human health risk assessments. And lastly, what are the underlying biological mechanisms, specifically looking at new mediators of toxicity, specifically surrounding extracellular vesicles. So to begin with, I'll start talking about some of our research that tries to address the question, what chemicals can drive toxicity associated with wildfire? And I wanted to highlight first that there are many difficulties when you're doing wildfire research, some of which are listed here. We know that wildfires are extremely variable and unpredictable, right? And because of this, it makes epidemiology investigations pretty difficult and potentially limited to retrospective analyses where smoke exposures are difficult to quantify and characterize after events occurred. At the same time, you can leverage lab-based approaches, right? But even these have certain limitations and precautions, and that they're extremely difficult to carry out. These exposure scenarios are difficult to generate in the lab and evaluate in a controlled setting. And this is partly because biomass combustions are dangerous and they can cause explosions to happen in the lab. It's also difficult to analyze the chemistry in PM conditions because they span a wide variety of chemistries that can occur during different wildfire events. And it's also difficult to couple exposures with the in vitro and in vivo test models that you're trying to evaluate in the lab because of these complications, right? So what do? You do team science. And what we did was we developed a partnership with folks at the EPA, specifically in an atmospheric chemistry and toxicology lab led by Ian Gilmore and Young Ho Kim. And what they have up and running is a really, really advantageous system in terms of evaluating wildfires, and that it's a tube furnace system that you can leverage to produce very controlled burn scenarios where you can select whatever biomasses you want to investigate or whatever burn conditions you want to investigate and put it inside the tube and heat a highly controlled ring that travels along the distance of the tube to burn the biomass at controlled temperatures and rates. And these can produce, you know, different biomass smoke conditions that can then be captured through a series of impingers and chemically evaluated. At the same time, we're measuring CO, CO2 and particle size, et cetera. You can also link this system to different in vivo and in vitro exposure chambers as well. So at the time of the study, we partnered with them at the EPA, and since then we've actually constructed a similar tube furnace system at UNC. So we're able to conduct these studies now at the EPA and UNC, which is really, really exciting. So shown here is the exposure design that we used for this particular study that I'm talking about, where we exposed mice to different biomass smoke exposure conditions that were produced across variable biomass types and also burn conditions. So we investigated flaming conditions and also smoldering conditions. And then mice were exposed to these different smoke conditions. And afterwards, we collected first toxicity markers from the mouse lung through BELF samples. They spanned immune cell counts, cytokine protein expression profiles, and lung injury markers. And then you'll hear me talk about in later slides, studies that we conducted digging further into molecular signatures. So first study that I was involved in was leveraging this kind of preliminary data set to identify which chemicals might be associated with wildfire-induced toxicity. And for this, we used a suite of different computational mixtures approaches to identify groups of chemicals that were associated with different biological responses in the lung. And using different clustering approaches, we identified chemicals that co-occurred across these variable biomass burn exposure scenarios. And then we related these groups of co-occurring chemicals to different tox endpoints to see which groups were associated with which outcomes. So shown here are some examples where we identified one cluster of chemicals that included inorganics and ionic constituents. And you can see here, they generally increased with the types of biomass burn scenarios associated with flaming conditions. And these chemicals were also associated with increases in IL-6. And then shown here is another example of co-occurring PAHs. And as PAHs increased, they seem to correlate with increases in lung macrophage count. So shown here is the wider spectrum of what we found in this analysis, where again, you can see this one module that we called the Brown module was highly associated with a lot of tox endpoints, as well as the yellow module. But what I thought was most interesting was this center green module that consisted of mostly methoxyphenols. And you can see here that there's actually an inverse relationship between this cluster of co-occurring chemicals and tox endpoints. So I really wanted to dig into this further using computational approaches to see if there was a potential protective effect associated with these chemicals. And we did this using quantile G computation, where we performed several mixtures models and related them to each of these tox endpoints. And we ran these models using three different scenarios shown here, including all chemicals except those in that green module, and then just the chemicals in that green module. And what you can see here pretty clearly is that there were a lot of significant relationships with models that were running all chemicals and all chemicals except those in the green module. But then conversely, the relationships to these tox endpoints actually significantly decreased when running the models with just the chemicals in the green module. So what does this, mean? It really actually substantiates our preliminary finding that we think that these chemicals that co-occur in that green module are actually good, and they're actually protecting us against toxicity associated with wildfire. So what's in these modules? Well, what we're finding in the green module is a lot of different methoxyphenols, including coniferyl aldehyde and eugenol, glycol and vanillin. And then what are in these bad modules? Well, these kind of include chemicals that we know to be kind of the bad actors, like several inorganics and also some ionic constituents. So what this study really highlighted was that mixtures modeling can be really helpful when you're trying to parse relationships between these complex exposures and health outcomes. These relationships weren't captured when doing individual chemical-based analyses. So that really highlights the utility of mixtures-based modeling. And right now, these studies are informing design of in vitro studies that we're piloting actually just this month to further parse the relationships and quantify and model these relationships between chemicals and wildfire exposures, leveraging in vitro models. So the next question we set out to answer are what exposure conditions are sufficiently similar to inform ongoing human health risk assessments. And if y'all don't know what sufficient similarity is, it's a type of method that's used to generally determine groups of exposures that are chemically and biologically similar enough to be regulated together for safety assessments. And so shown here is kind of an infographic of what that is, where in this hypothetical mixture number one, we know exposure information and toxicity information for this mixture, so we're able to assess its risk. But what we don't know are exposure information and toxicity information for this other mixture. But can we use information from mixture number one to inform mixture number two? Well, that hinges upon whether or not these mixtures are sufficiently similar. And there's been other studies done in this research field of sufficient similarity, some of which are shown here. They include studies on disinfection drinking byproducts and also nutritional supplements. And so for this study, we looked at which exposure conditions are similar using different clustering approaches. And it's no surprise that we found that a lot of the flaming exposure conditions clustered together, and as well as the smoldering conditions. And we also wanted to leverage more mechanistic-based signatures to see if those could also inform sufficient similarity. And we did this using transcriptomic similarities scoring, which is a new method that we piloted. And it's based off of Jaccard distance similarity metrics between gene alterations. And we did find really great grouping between exposure scenarios where flaming peat always grouped with the positive inflammatory control, followed by a lot of the flaming scenarios and then the smoldering scenarios. And these notably lined up with changes in pulmonary toxicity markers. And we found similar results. So that was just looking at the 4 hours post-exposure. We found similar results 24 hours post-exposure. So this kind of shows a graphical summary from this study where starting here on the left are the most, the conditions inducing the most biological responses. And then if you go to the right, those are the conditions causing the least biological responses. And in general, there were largely consistent groupings when looking at transcriptomic profiles, toxicity phenotypes, and across different post-exposure time periods. But there were some inconsistencies when you were looking at chemical signature data. And this is in line with previous. Oh, yeah.
Just to jump in, just giving you about a 5-minute warning here.
Oh, 5 minutes. Okay. I can do that. This was similar to other studies that have been performed in complex mixtures, basically. And our future research efforts are going to incorporate more global chemical approaches, including non-targeted analysis, to more globally capture exposure signatures and do sufficient similarity analyses off of that. And I did want to mention some really exciting initiatives that I'm involved with through UNC Superfund is kind of taking these data sets and leveraging them for training purposes. One of those training purposes is shown here. It's highlighted through an online data science training toolkit called the TAME toolkit, stands for Intelligence and Machine Learning. And this is actually the specific example going over the data that I just showed you on the previous slides, where we looked at different biomass burn scenarios and used different, you know, high dimensional data analysis approaches to analyze it and then train trainees on how to analyze these kinds of data sets. So that's really exciting. And y'all are welcome to go to those websites if you want to leverage this training material as well. And then lastly, I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to really quickly go over what we're currently doing for biological mechanisms in terms of wildfire research. Something that I'm really excited about are extracellular vesicles. And these are just newly discovered particles that remained really understudied in relation to chemical safety and risk. And we've put out some recent reviews exploring approaches that we could incorporate these new mechanisms of disease and mediators of disease into exposure science, toxicology, and public health, shown here. And just really quickly, we have incorporated extracellular vesicles into ongoing wildfire toxicity research. If you want to read more, there's this article that was just published in Environment International highlighting extracellular vesicles as critical mediators of cross-tissue mechanisms of disease associated with wildfire. So click through these. And we're also developing in vitro methods to look at these new particles and their role in responses to biomass smoke exposures, which is shown here. So overall, the studies that I've been involved with so far clearly highlight that it's really impossible to test every chemicals in wildfire, either individually or across different combinations. That's why it's really important to leverage data science approaches and in silico approaches to decrease overall our reliance upon animal testing and also further inform future in vitro and in vivo study designs more efficiently. And what can we do with these findings? Well, I think these data can play a critical role in improving risk characterizations over these complex exposure conditions. So I'll go ahead and conclude and thank my collaborators and funding, including the UNC Superfund Research Program.
Great. Thank you so much. And we have quite a few questions that have come in, particularly around, you know, related to kind of the set of health, human health issues that you talked about. And I'm going to kind of weave a couple of them together and maybe give you a chance to kind of just, you know, answer more collectively. So the first one would be around, you know, what are some of the co-exposures that should be considered when evaluating the kind of human health impacts of wildfire events? And, you know, related to that, do you see kind of wildland firefighters needing to kind of increase their use of respirators as a result of some of your studies? There was also something that kind of tied into that, that related to kind of like just an interest in some of the products that you talked about that were actually good actors. And there was just curiosity, you know, particularly as they relate to health, are there, what are they? Like, what are they found in? Like, where would you find those types of compounds? And then the third one, it wasn't really framed as a question, but I think that it's relevant, which is how do you take this from the like individual scale to the community scale and really evaluating the long-term health effects in some of these communities? And coming from Washington State, that just came off a month of really disastrous, you know, wildfire-induced kind of air quality, love to hear about kind of how some of this, you know, fits in with that community level kind of impacts. So it's kind of tying a lot of health things together to give you some flexibility on how to answer.
I don't know where to begin, but these are all really, really great topics. So as far as, you know, co-exposures are, what's really exciting to me is evaluating all the crazy conditions that can occur during wildfire events. One aspect that remains extremely understudied are different anthropogenic material burns that really might have a higher role in the health impacts, especially in communities where historically we've kind of just been focused on biomass, sole biomass burn exposures. So that might make it more community applicable, and we're working on ways to do that. That also comes with complications because those materials really do have high risk of exploding in a lab. So you have to do it in a very controlled and safe manner. But we do have methods to do that, and we're working on that. And we're also working on methods to incorporate things like PFAS into that, right? That we now know is ubiquitous, and especially in firefighter foam, but yet we haven't evaluated that, right? So that's also really applicable in terms of kind of parsing out protective measures that communities can do and also firefighters can do. Some exciting research that we're involved in is looking at different protective gear that everyone now has access to in their everyday lives now that we're in COVID, or face masks, right? When is that protective and when is it not? What class of chemicals might it filter out and in what conditions? And then what do we still have to worry about? So stay tuned for that research. That's also happening at UNC and EPA. And I think that's I can already tell you that it works for some chemicals and not for all. So it's not like I can tell you, I'll go home and put on your mask when there's a wildfire event, because that won't protect you against everything, right? But I hope that gets at some of your questions. Thank you.
Yeah. Although it sounds like, you know, go home and put on your mask might be help with some of the exposures. And so it's not a, and did you have like any kind of like types of products that are, you know, some of those chemicals are in that were in the kind of green category?
Yeah. So we know that those kinds of chemicals are prevalent in obviously natural things like trees. They're also found in different supplements, although I'm not going to promote that. Like, we haven't studied, you know, can you take that as a supplement and is it good for you? Right. It's what I've studied is, the interaction of those chemicals in concert with this complex adverse mixture. So I'm excited to further parse those relationships moving forward as we continue to get more and more data.
Great. So there was a question that came up around kind of the PFAS, which you just mentioned a minute ago. And are you also looking at the PFAS migration and kind of accumulation post-fire?
Oh, yeah, that's a really interesting thought, right? I actually don't know if there are folks doing that, but you think that they should be. I haven't been on that arm yet, but now it's making me want to design more studies. And we certainly have scientists in my department that are well recognized for measuring PFAS in different media. So you can imagine leveraging those resources and maybe responding to some of these new funding initiatives to tackle that issue.
And then did your research look at kind of, you know, more chronic or long-term effects of exposure and how kind of could your kind of more mechanistic research, you know, help feed information about some of those longer term kind of impacts and exposure, you know, of exposures?
Yeah, absolutely. What's really important is to figure out when do biological changes become permanent and what's transient, and do transient biological mediator changes lead to permanent changes, right? These are all really good questions. And what I'm excited about extracellular vesicle research is that those particles are really stable. So I'm not excited about this, but they have the potential to stick around for a very long time, inducing adverse effects long after those exposure scenarios, either through transmitting adverse chemicals or different molecules that were impacted by exposures throughout the body. So that could be one type of mechanism that I would be excited to further investigate. And we're also in the process of designing other in vivo studies to look at even longer time points outside of 28 days.
Great. So one last question, and then we'll kind of move to closing this up, which is kind of on a slightly different track. Are you looking at metal-driven oxidative stress, including by copper smoke particulates?
Oxidative stress, yes. That's one of my, that's a very high-hitting pathway that I see a lot. So HIF-1-alpha specifically is involved in hypoxia, which results from oxidative stress. And also other cell stress pathways are really the top hitters when I'm looking at these high-dimensional omics screens, actually. So you'll see those pathways highlighted a lot in our research papers. So yes, we're looking into that.
Great. Well, thank you to all of our speakers for really informative, I kind of hesitated, inspiring, just because it's such, you know, hard information to hear. But I really thank you for your research and your commitment to kind of making the impacts of climate change less over time on human health, so as we, you know, kind of increase the information. So let me just kind of close us up here. And before we conclude, I want to take a look back at kind of our seminar homepage. This website will be active from today on and contains important resources such as links to download the presentation materials, contact information for our speakers, and a link to our feedback form. We ask you to please consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. And your feedback is really important to us so that we can give you the information that you need through these webinars. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I'd also like to remind the participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the cluin.org website. You can also subscribe to our free monthly e-newsletter, Tech Direct, and we encourage you to visit the RISC e-learning webpage and subscribe to the RISC e-learning listserv for information on upcoming sessions. You can also follow us on Twitter. And then kind of finally, I would like to encourage everyone to join us for the last session in this webinar series on November 18th, which will be highlighting how climate-related disasters and exposure to harmful chemicals redistributed during these events affect people's health and well-being. We encourage you to register now, and if you cannot attend, an archive will be made available after the event. Also, if you missed the first session about reducing exposures and promoting resilience, a recorded archive is now available online. With that, it is time to conclude today's webinar. If you submitted an online question and we didn't have time to get to it, we'll pass those questions along to the presenters who can follow up. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. Their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on CLUIN. And then finally, I want to sincerely thank our presenters for their time spent preparing and sharing their presentations with us today. This concludes today's presentation. Thank you for your participation.